Thanks so much for joining us today on Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, and today we explore the Mississippi River to begin the show, the geological, the cultural, the natural history of the river, and what you can see and do along it. And we have a great guide for you, Dean Klinkenberg. He is the author of the new book, The Wild Mississippi, A State-by-State Guide to the River's Natural Wonders. Dean was an academic psychologist before becoming an author of guidebooks and mystery novels, and it's great to have him with us today. So as we talk about the Mississippi, I hope you'll join in. Have you visited many places along the Mississippi River? What's your favorite? Where would you like to go next? Questions about the river or its history? I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Dean Klinkenberg, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us today.
Hey, Larry, thanks so much for having me on. I'm really looking forward to talking about my favorite subject.
Well, I tell you what, you've written a dandy book here. One of the things I really liked about the book was you spend a fair amount of time in the beginning, the first chapters, dealing with the kind of the history and what has made the Mississippi River the kind of the way it is. And I'm sure you were very purposeful about that, because I think it gives us some background before we actually get into visiting along the place.
Yeah, absolutely. I was surprised as I got into this, learning how much we do know, and then also how much we don't know about the river's geologic past. There was a study maybe 3 or 4 years ago that suggested the river's been around for 70 million years, and that just kind of blew my mind.
And it's a lot smaller, I guess, today than it was. It carried 8 times as much water at one point.
Yeah, I think this is one of the things that it's hard for us to sometimes understand how dynamic the river can be. And at different points in time, the river has been much bigger. It's been much smaller. Of course, it's changed its channel a few times here and there, depending upon what was going on. Sometimes ice pushed it an entirely new channel. So the river has been through a lot of changes in its 70 million history, as one would hope.
Yeah, as for sure. And as I understand it, the river is expected to grow bigger once again.
Yeah, I mean, there's a combination of a couple different factors at play here. But the short version of this is, you know, when the glaciers cover land, the land sinks. And then as the glaciers retreat, the land rises back up. And the land, especially in Canada, is still rising in response to the glaciers leaving. And that's probably going to change the size of the Mississippi's watershed and force more water into the Mississippi Valley. We're not going to be around to see much of an effect of that, but we are seeing precipitation changes, especially up in your part of the river, where you know you've had a lot of rain again this spring. Precipitation trends are up, particularly in the upper half of the river, but along much of it, which is making the river bigger again as well.
So we're going to talk a little more about the history. The European impact on Native Americans was obviously great. The displacement of many indigenous peoples. And that reshaped the settlement of the Mississippi.
Yeah, it's hard to get a handle on exactly how many different indigenous tribes or communities lived along the river, but we know indigenous people lived along the Mississippi for probably at least 13,000 years down on the lower part of the river and probably at least 12,000 on the upper part of the river. Lots of communities, close ties to the river, dependent upon the river for their sustenance. And then as Europeans came in and forced those indigenous communities out, it sort of changed the nature of the relationship we have, that humans have with the Mississippi, and it changed the lives and lifestyles of the indigenous people that used to live here.
Yeah, yeah. I was interested in some of the things that happened. Steamboats. The introduction of steamboats on the river before the Civil War and the effect it had on the area. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, if you think about like the difference in transportation time from something as simple as like driving to New York versus flying to New York, you know, before steamboats, you know, people basically, you know, they could travel downriver, but they were at the mercy of the current. And then they either had this laborious prospect of pulling a boat upriver, essentially, from there, or walking back or horseback riding along the river. It could take weeks to travel along the river. And a steamboat, you could do that same trip in a matter of days. So it made the world a lot smaller. And we've seen some changes like that in our world, I think, with how communication has made the world feel smaller as well. But this really transformed and opened up parts of the country to new settlements and that previously were difficult to get to and supply.
Yeah. And then, of course, railroads came along and kind of replaced the steamboats.
Pretty much. They pretty much rendered steamboats and a lot of river transportation irrelevant.
At one point, you write, which I thought was a really interesting way to put it, you write that we have tamed the Mississippi River not as well as a domesticated dog, but more like a wolf cub raised by humans.
Yeah, I think we have this illusion that we've kind of controlled the river, but really that river is pretty sneaky, and a lot of the structures that we've built, they have assumptions about what kind of river we're trying to control. And as, you know, as we said earlier, the river is already changing and growing some, and there's some questions about how well these structures might hold up to increasing amounts of water that are almost inevitably coming our way.
Yeah, yeah. How much of the river have you paddled? Have you paddled quite a bit of it?
I've done small segments. I know I have friends who've paddled the whole river. Probably my favorite trip is a few years ago, I got to paddle with a group in a big canoe from New Orleans to the Gulf of Mexico and camp our last night on a barrier island. That was one of my favorite trips of all time. I'm trying to get more miles in canoes and kayaks, but it takes me a little while.
Well, you know, the river's tame in spots. I think it's kind of wild in spots. In your mind, where is the river the wildest?
You know, surprisingly, I think some of the wildest parts of the river are the lower Mississippi. You know, I've had the good luck of going on some canoe trips on the lower Mississippi, besides that one to the Gulf. And my preconception before that first trip was that the area between the levees down there was going to be kind of sterile and uninteresting. And and I got in a canoe and we got going, and I was surprised at how remote it felt, how much life really did thrive in those areas. In some places, the space between the levees is pretty narrow, and in others, it's not. But there are islands full of beavers and muskrats and lots of birds and turtles. And you can go, I think the longest stretch is 60 or 70 miles between bridges. And there are very few communities along the river down there. So it feels pretty remote when you're on a boat traveling down that part of the river.
You mentioned the narrowness at one point, at least, but it's wide in some points. What's the widest part of the river?
Yeah, I like to joke that that's a good way to start an argument among river rats, is asking where the widest part of the river is. Yes, I think if you're looking at below the Twin Cities, the pool at Fulton and Clinton, that area, is technically the widest right now, where the water stays, it's like 2.5-ish miles, I think, wide at that point. Lake Pepin is the widest natural segment of the river below the Twin Cities. But up north, you know, the Mississippi passes through Lake Winnie, which is, 11 miles wide? So I guess it depends on which lake you want to count, but I like to say it's Lake Winnie.
Oh, man. How much sediment moves down the river?
Well, not as much as they're used to. So, you know, obviously that muddy color we associate with the Mississippi is from sediment. It's not from pollution. A lot of people think that it's, you know, something that's we should avoid and terrible. But it's just dirt. It's just sediment the river carries. The dams on the Missouri River have blocked a lot of the sediment that flowed down the Missouri River. And really, the Missouri historically contributed the bulk of the sediment to the lower Mississippi. The upper Mississippi used to run pretty clear when you read the stories from travelers who were along the river a couple hundred years ago. They lauded how beautiful the clear water was of the upper Mississippi. But modern agriculture has dumped more sediment into the Mississippi than it used to, and the upper part of the river And now the navigation dams trap a lot of that sediment behind those dams.
Yeah. And I'm just, how is the channelization, the building of levees and dams, it's had a big, huge impact on, I think, everything, but including wildlife. And I wondered about wildlife.
Yeah, but the channelization is problematic more, I think, in certain segments than in other. Like right now, we're celebrating the 100th birthday of the Upper Mississippi Refuge. And there, channelization has been a little bit less of an issue. You still have connections between a lot of the river's historic habitats and ecosystems. But you go south of the Quad Cities and the river's not really connected to many wetlands anymore. So there's a lot of, there's some loss of species and abundance along that part of the river because there's just nothing to support that kind of life. And the channelization is kind of, you know, in my part of the river especially, like the Mississippi is almost acting like a small stream sometimes. Like the river is more subject to dramatic rises and falls than it was historically because of the channelization of the river.
Yeah, it's amazing. Are there any rapids on the Mississippi?
There are, mostly up north. Yeah, there's a series of small rapids through northern Minnesota, like Pakegama Falls around Grand Rapids is one of the better known stretches. There was also a stretch of rapids around the Quad Cities and around Keokuk. Those are now submerged by the navigation dams. And out, down here in my area, the Chain of Rocks was an area of rapids as well.
Well, you go through a nice history, and we've really given a thumbnail sketch of it, but maybe talk about the book itself, aside from this history and background and learning about the river, then we get into places that we can go and see.
Yeah, so the model in my head for this book was kind of like a city guide. Like if you bought a guidebook for Paris, it would give you some history of Paris, and it would give you a description of the neighborhoods of the city. And it would give you some highlights of things to see and do. But it wouldn't tell you about every single building in Paris. And I think this book kind of follows that model. So the first half of the book really peels back the layers in the river's world. So there are chapters on main channel and, you know, what kind of life lives in and depends on flowing water. Wetlands, forests, and grasslands are also additional chapters. So the book kind of describes in pretty general terms what those habitats and ecosystems are like and what kind of life they generally support. And then the second half of the book is a state-by-state listing for all 10 states that touch the main channel of the Mississippi, listing public lands where people can go to have experiences that experience different parts of the river's world. I wanted there to be some range in the experiences. So there are places of wetlands, there are places with grasslands, places you can just have a nice view of the river. And all of them are easy to get to.
Yeah. Our guest today, it's great to have him with us to talk about the Mississippi River and what's going on and what we can all see there. Dean Klinkenberg is our author today for this first segment of our show, and his book is titled The Wild Mississippi, A State-by-State Guide to the River's Natural Wonders. Questions, comments, maybe some experiences you've had along the river? I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Cheryl in Clark County has called to say that they've read the book and enjoyed it very much, Dean. She's curious to know how much is known about the indigenous people who built the mounds and why they built the mounds.
Yeah, boy, I would say there's speculation, but it's hard to know for sure some of the why. Mound building has a long history in North America. I think the earliest mounds that we know of were built in southern Louisiana or in Louisiana at a place called Watson Break over 5,000 years ago. And that mound building culture then kind of spread along the Mississippi. There's speculation that, you know, some of the mounds were for burials, but many of them were for symbolic reasons. And I'm certainly not an expert in indigenous spiritual views, but my understanding is that a lot of the times they would choose the tops of bluffs near rivers as a way to sort of get closer to the upper world that they believed was part of their cosmological system. So it was a way to connect the world where people lived with the upper world where some of the other spiritual beings lived. But there are, I'm sure there are lots of other things about the mound building we'll never fully understand.
Yeah. Cahokia in Illinois, I think it's east of St. Louis, that Cahokia Mounds historic site, very significant site.
Yeah, and I don't know if you've ever been there yourself, you've had a chance to travel down here. It's one of those sites, I think, to myself, if they had built with stone instead of dirt, it would be as famous as Machu Picchu or the pyramids of Egypt. It was a remarkable city that was built over 1,000 years ago, and most of it seemed to have been built practically overnight in one big burst of construction. What archaeologist Timothy, I'm going to butcher his name, Pocketuck, calls the Cahokia Big Bang. So this happened very rapidly, and the city had tens of thousands of people living in the main city and in surrounding villages during its peak. Very complex cultural systems. So I think it's, you know, at the time it was bigger than London. It's just, it was a remarkable place, and it's remarkable to me how much we do know about it. But there's still a lot of questions about like, what happened to it ultimately and what day-to-day life was like.
Yeah, absolutely. Barbara in Cross Plains has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Barbara. We lose Barbara? Oh, we must have lost Barbara. That's too bad. She had a question. Well, she was commenting on Lansing, Iowa, and the beautiful Riverside. Oh, well, I think we've got her back. Barbara, are you there?
Yes. Can you hear me now?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, I'm so excited you're on today because a week ago we discovered the city park in Lansing when we went over the bridge that's just recently been reopened, crossing from Wisconsin over to Lansing. And there is a city park there with two overlooks, one higher than the other. And you look down on the Mississippi going in both directions. And I always thought Wyalusing's outlook from the confluence of the Mississippi and Wisconsin was the best. Well, this might almost beat it. And I can't believe that'll happen, not in Wisconsin. But it's Mount Hosner Park. And outside of town is a wonderful interpretive center with all kinds of really basic, easy to understand information about the Mississippi, the traffic, the barges. I'm very excited about this new find.
Barbara, thanks a lot for calling. Comment, Dean.
She's right. That's a spectacular view from there. I've made it one of my missions to try to get on top of every bluff that's publicly accessible as I can to try to see where the best views are. And Mount Hosmer and Lansing certainly is among the best. I'd be hard pressed to choose which one is actually best, but Great River Bluff State Park has magnificent views. Buena Vista Park in Alma, Wisconsin, also spectacular views from up there. So I think people should just make it a mission to collect all those bluff top overlooks, and then we can all discuss which ones they like best.
Lansing, Iowa. Well, what about, in fact, in your book, you mentioned Pikes Peak State Park near McGregor, Iowa. Talk about that.
One of the things I like about that, it's a very popular spot to stop for the overlook, and I think for good reason, because part of the reason that it's so spectacular there is you're looking directly at the confluence of the Wisconsin and Mississippi rivers. So this nice complex of islands and back channels that you can see from up there. The park itself is really beautiful too, and there's some nice hiking trails that most people never explore, but the overlook really is beautiful. I've been there all times of year, and I find it spectacular even in the middle of winter.
Yeah, and as long as we're talking about Iowa, and I kind of wanted to zero in on the places we can drive in a day and in sort of the Midwest states that are along the river. And another thing you mentioned is the National Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium. That's located in Dubuque, Iowa.
Yeah, boy, it's just one of the best museums about the river that I think you'll ever find. They have aquariums with fish, native fish and wildlife, so you can see what a blue catfish looks like. They're gigantic. There are tanks with turtles and other amphibians and reptiles. And then they have aquariums also that showcase the life at the the end of the river support. So more of these coastal habitats. So there's tanks with fish that thrive in those coastal habitats. Plus, there are lots of exhibits on our history with the river, indigenous history, navigation. It's really a spectacular place. There's a reason there's a Smithsonian affiliate. It's because they just do everything so well.
Let's go back up. Let's go further north from Iowa to neighboring Minnesota and some of the places along the path of the Mississippi River that might be worth visiting. Of course, the headwaters are at Itasca State Park, are they not?
They are. So that's Itasca State Park is absolutely one of my favorite spots to go. It's a little bit of a drive for me from St. Louis. Wouldn't be quite so bad from Wisconsin. But it's another one of these places where I think you can, in some places, you can kind of step back in time. There are patches of old growth pine forest intact in Itasca State Forest or Itasca State Park. I really like hiking through those areas to get a sense of what those old forests might have felt like to walk through. But the park has, you know, a fantastic lodge to stay at and cabins, a big campground, and then you can paddle on Lake Itasca itself. And maybe if you're lucky, you'll be there on a day when some long-distance paddler is putting in a kayak on their way down to the Gulf of Mexico.
That'd be pretty cool. And you can walk from bank to bank there at some point.
You can, and you're probably not going to get your knees wet unless you're a child. So.
And the elevation, that interested me. It's, I think you point out, it's 1,475 feet above sea level. And then, of course, it takes a pretty good drop as it goes down.
Yeah, the river drops more than half of its elevation toward the Gulf of Mexico just within Minnesota. it flattens out quite a bit after that.
Oh, man, that's amazing to me. Well, the Mississippi National River and Recreation Area, it runs, I think it's 72 miles, and runs through the Twin Cities. How well protected is that section of the river?
I think it's a bit of a mixed bag. I think a lot of it is fairly well protected. There's a lot of public land right next to the river that both Minneapolis and St. Paul made an effort to protect long ago. In the suburbs, some of the land, there's a lot more private land that's a little harder for the National Refuge or Recreation Area to manage. But it's still like there are really fantastic places you can get near the river or on the river in that 72-mile stretch. And I think people in the Twin Cities are pretty well aware of how special that is and do spend a fair amount of time out on there. Living in St. Louis, where our riverfront is highly industrial and dominated by the navigation industry, every time I go up to the Twin Cities, I'm envious of how easy they have access to the river and how easy it is to get on there.
Yeah, and I think you particularly cite Minneapolis as just a beautiful place to, because you can go right down to the water's edge.
Yeah, and the river changes a lot just within the borders of Minneapolis. So the only gorge in the whole path of the Mississippi goes through Minneapolis. So there's a really big changes you can see. And when the river enters the Twin Cities, it's kind of a small prairie river in some ways, a little slow and not real deep. And then it passes through the gorge, and then eventually it makes a sharp turn into St. Paul and then turns south into the beautiful Valley of the Driftless area that probably most folks are familiar with.
Joel Patnaud, our producer for this show, wanted to point out the Kiona County State Recreation Area. It's a former iron ore mining site, now a popular place for mountain biking, as I understand it.
Yeah, I mean, part of the reason I wanted to include that in the book, it's centered around Crosby, Minnesota. So a couple of hours, maybe 2.5 hours away from the Twin Cities, depending upon where you're starting. It's an area where they had open pit mines that closed a long time ago, and nature sort of overtook or retook that place back. So you have some of the open pit mines are now deep lakes, and the hills that were the scraps from the mining era are now growing trees and other vegetation. So it's become a very popular place for mountain biking or just to kind of go to get away for a weekend. There's a lot of recreation opportunities there.
Yeah. Roger in Grantsburg, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Roger.
Hey, Larry, how are you doing today?
Great, appreciate the call.
I was just wondering if your host or your guest, I live up in Grantsburg by the St. Croix. I'm only about 10 miles from the St. Croix River. And I wonder if you'd spend any time on that. That's a tributary of the Mississippi that flows in at Prescott, Wisconsin. And I wonder if you've ever spent any time up there.
Yeah.
I have. I've spent some time on the lower St. Croix. Yeah, more around like Hudson and then down to Prescott in that area. And it's really beautiful there. It's got some similarities geologically, I think, to the Mississippi. Some of that part of the St. Croix was also essentially carved by glacial meltwaters a few thousand years ago. So you have the valley that looks pretty similar. But it's a beautiful spot, and I probably ought to spend more time in a canoe up there.
As I was going back to your book and looking at you, you have some really cool photos of the major tributaries of the Mississippi, which are really a cool shots.
Thanks. I got lucky a couple of years ago where I got to be a host to talk with a couple of politicians who were flying over the Mississippi from St. Louis down to Cairo, where the Ohio River meets the Mississippi. And I got to take a lot of pictures from there. So I got a really nice picture of the Ohio River from that plane.
Yeah, you did indeed. Roger, thanks again. Appreciate it. Jim in Newport Township, Illinois. Hi, Jim.
Yes, hello. According to knowledge I've been exposed to, at the confluence of the upper Mississippi with the Missouri, on average, about 70% of the flow is actually coming from the Missouri River. So, I mean, some people argue that it's not to take away that there are many wondrous things about the upper Mississippi, but it's like the Mississippi is flowing into the Missouri River rather than the way we accept it.
Then the other way around. Okay, well, what do you think, Dean?
It's funny. This is the second best way to start an argument among river rats is to ask which name should carry south from there. I have an entire presentation I put together just on this issue. So I'll give you the short version of it is really like historically, the Missouri and the upper Mississippi carried a fairly similar amount of water. It's a little hard to judge today because the flow of the Missouri River is managed by the dams on the upper part of the Missouri. So it's not a natural flow anymore. It is managed. But historically, the Missouri would come up at a certain time of the year and then fall back. But if you average the volume over time, the two rivers were pretty similar. The Missouri is longer. So that's, some people point to that. I like to think it's the Mississippi that's the river that's going north to south, and the Missouri is crashing into it. So it seems like the Mississippi ought to be, for that reason and others, maybe that's the name that should be carrying forward.
Oh, boy. Jim, thanks a lot. And water. I mean, water, you write in the book that water across 1.25 million acres flows into the river.
It is a very big watershed. I think it's the third or fourth largest watershed in the world. And what's really crazy when you think about that is how concentrated all that water becomes further south. So by the time you get around like Vicksburg and Natchez and that part, all of that water, all these big rivers have fed into the Mississippi, and it's all in this one channel as it passes by Vicksburg, Baton Rouge, New Orleans. Now, there's some that's ciphered off above Baton Rouge, but that's an awful lot of water from a continent being funneled into one narrow channel.
It is indeed. Janie in Sugar Creek, Wisconsin, it's your turn. Hi, Janie.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. I heard you talking about overlooks on the Mississippi, and I thought of my home area, which is Burlington, Iowa, and there is a property on a bluff above, or actually below, if you're talking river, below, Burlington, and it's on Clay Street off of South Main, and it is the Leopold Dankwart property, and that's where our beloved Aldo Leopold grew up.
Ah, there you go.
That's right. Yeah, I didn't know that until I started doing some research, more research about Burlington a few years ago, Aldo Leopold's hometown. Almost certainly his childhood growing up near the Mississippi had some effect on his view of the natural world. And Burlington has its own big river history and some great places to see and experience the river. There's a pretty good culture of having cabins on islands in the Mississippi there, from what I understand. I got to visit one a few years ago and ride out there in a John boat and enjoy a couple of beers with somebody I just met as we watched the river flow. So kind of like a universal river activity.
Janie, thanks a lot for calling. I did not know that Burlington, Iowa is the childhood home of Aldo Leopold. So there you go. You can join in too, by the way. We're getting some great calls. What about experiences or things to share about the river? Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. I want to turn our attention a bit to Wisconsin, because in the book, I went and counted, you had 14 parks and wilderness and wildlife areas along the Mississippi on the Wisconsin side. That's got to be thousands of acres.
Yeah, and I had to leave some places out. So, yeah, Minnesota, Wisconsin especially, are blessed with a lot of public lands, and it made it difficult for me to figure out which ones to include and which ones to leave out. But part of it is, it is a lot of acres and it's growing. There are some organizations that are still buying private property along the river to preserve for future generations. So I wanted to make sure to include places that had a good mix of ecosystems and opportunities. So, you know, I ended up leaving out some really nice places just because I kind of duplicated something else. But I hope people will use this as a starting point. These, you know, the 14 places in Wisconsin, I think are really exceptional places and have a lot to offer. But there are a lot of other places I hope they'll also just take some time to explore, like the state natural areas. Like, I think everybody probably is familiar with the state parks and probably the wildlife refuges, but there are a lot of properties that are state natural areas that aren't as managed and don't have the number of visitors as the state parks and refuges tend to. They can be quieter places to visit.
Yeah, they can indeed. And, you know, this just back in history just a bit there, in 1924, I believe, the Upper Mississippi River National Wildlife and Fish Refuge, you point out, was established. It was really interesting because there was a group of women who were important in getting this established.
Yeah, it took a coalition of people to really pull that off. And Will Dilg gets a lot of credit as the main person pushing and lobbying for this refuge, but he was one of the co-founders of the Isaac Walton League. But they could not have done it without the support of women's groups, without the support of other conservationists and some hunters. That what they did is they managed to get this refuge established essentially in one congressional session, which you think about how hard it is to get anything done today. And they did this in a few months, essentially. This something that had never, you know, they passed this legislation and creating this refuge that had never been done on that scale before in this country. So we're still benefiting from that.
Yeah, I was thinking about the upper, the refuge in the, and they're different districts. So like the Winona district, for example, there's a dandy refuge right there.
Absolutely. I have a podcast about the Mississippi, and the last episode I released, I got to talk with the refuge manager and the visitor services coordinator from the Upper Miss Refuge. And there are so many fantastic places within the refuge itself. And I think part of the problem they struggle with is, you know, it's not like a state park and that there are real clear boundaries. Like, you know, when you're in the state park, because, well, in Minnesota, Wisconsin, you got to pay a fee to go in for one thing or have a sticker. But for the refuge, you can just wander in, and you may not realize that you're in territory that's part of this national refuge. So they're doing their part to make it easy, you know, make it more obvious which parts of the refuge. But there's some beautiful spots.
And along Wisconsin, what do we got? We got 230 miles of, you look at, as you say, bluffs, thick forest, and wetlands.
Yeah, so pick a spot. Like, you can't really lose, you know, with all that.
Oh, man. Bob in Cottage in Barnes, Wisconsin.
Hello, Larry.
Hi, Bob.
That was quick.
Well, how are things in Barnes?
Oh, it's beautiful, sunny, and about 68 degrees and wonderful and no bugs.
That's good to hear. We've got a cabin in Barnes area. So, well, what's your question or comment?
Well, my comment was that years ago we took houseboat rides up to from La Crosse to Winona and had a wonderful time. And then Bemidji, Minnesota was supposedly the start of the Mississippi River. Is that right?
Well, it's close. Bemidji's slogan is the first city on the Mississippi, but the river actually starts a bit downriver, like 60 miles at Itasca State Park.
But it's the first city.
Yes. And they make a big deal about that.
Oh, Bob, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Dean Klinkenberg, our guest today, we're talking about his new book out, Sandy. It's called The Wild Mississippi, A State-by-State Guide to the River's Natural Wonders. You can join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or shoot an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking with Dean Klinkenberg, who has written The Wild Mississippi, A State-by-State Guide to the River's Natural Wonders. Great to have him with us. And again, you can join in. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you can email to talk@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Therese emailed to say they visited Wyalusing State Park many times, loves the view from campsites up on the cliff, and while paddling on the Mississippi River there, they've seen water snakes, a ton of fish. It's surprisingly calm and fascinating area, and Teresa added that the entire Driftless area has great rivers.
Oh, yeah, I'm not going to argue with that. So I love Wyalusing State Park as well. One of the things that's spectacular, and I'm not giving any secrets away with this. I think if you live in the area, you know this already, but there are a string of campground or campsites that are right on the edge of the bluff at Wyalusing State Park, and I've been lucky enough to camp there a handful of times. They go fast, especially on weekends. But it's really, the views are like million-dollar views, and you're just paying for a campsite. So I think that's, you know, it's a great opportunity for just about anybody to be able to enjoy those spectacular views. But the park has a paddle trail, you know, a canoe trail that takes you through the backwaters, and it has hiking trails along the bluff and down to the floodplain forest. But this is kind of typical, as she was saying, for places along the Driftless area. There are lots of parks and nature areas and private places that you might be able to access that also have the same amenities. So we're very lucky to have access to it.
Yeah, absolutely. And you, in the book, you write that you really love the Trempealeau National Wildlife Refuge. Talk about it and why you love it.
If you like bird watching, and I'm not an expert birder, like I'm partially colorblind, so I'm never going to be a great birder. Yeah, I have an app that I use to help me identify what's around me by the sounds or the songs the birds are making. But at Trempealeau Refuge, you don't really need much of an app. There's a big area of wetlands with an easy view of the visitor center that attracts a lot of waterfowl, especially in the spring and fall. And I've seen beavers in some of the backwater habitats. There's a dike you can hike out along about half a mile or three quarters of a mile that passes through these wetland habitats where there's often a lot of mammals and other wildlife going on. I just find it a very peaceful place. one of the unfortunate things about some of the parks along the Mississippi is that sometimes there are train tracks that run right next to them or through them. So sometimes the noise can get to be a lot. But at Trempealeau Refuge, the train tracks are far away. It's not next to the highway. So I think there's a quietness and a serenity to that place that a lot of other places don't have. And just so much, you know, so many birds to watch.
Jeff and Barry Mills, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Jeff.
Yes, I just wanted to bring up a book I read quite a few years back. I don't recall who the author was. I think the book was The History of the Mississippi River from the Beginning of Time. It talks about how most of North America was just a lake or something at the time, and I found it to be just fascinating.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't think of the author on that one. Dean, do you?
I'm not familiar with that book. No, I may have to look that up and see if I can find it. I did a fair amount of research on the geology of the Mississippi River and North America when I was writing that first chapter. So what I have in there is a really thumbnail sketch of that history. But it is really fascinating to get into the details of how the Mississippi developed and how it changed over time.
Jeff, thank you for calling. Prairie in Clyde, Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Oh, hey, yeah, I was so excited to turn on the radio and hear you talking about the Mississippi. We, about 12 years ago, my partner and I did a bike trip, went down a good bit of it, at least between here and central Missouri. And we've kind of always had a daydream of loading the family up.
Oh, we lost him. We lost him. I bet he was thinking about loading the family up and taking them the whole length.
Yeah.
Are you back, Bray?
Yeah. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry. We've had this daydream of doing like a houseboat or a longer term, you know, camping and river, you know, exploring it from the river. And I wonder if, you know, is that realistic? Do people still do that? Yeah. What do you think about that idea?
Yeah.
People do it. You know, there's a small community of people who do the Great Circle, you know, the route that basically goes through the Great Lakes down the Mississippi and the Intercoastal Waterway and then back up the East Coast and down the St. Lawrence River. They're certainly doing that. There are some people who do some longer term boat trips on the Mississippi. I think at this point, it's mostly paddlers who are doing those kinds of trips. That I hear about, but there may be others in houseboats or other kinds of boats. But it's also just an easy place to drive along. There are a lot of campgrounds along the river, some of them right next to the river, some of them big enough to accommodate big RVs and others that might only be, you know, ideal for a tent. So there are lots of different ways to explore it.
Yeah, that Great River Road is, I think probably if you're driving, that's probably think about the Mississippi River, that's probably the best drive you're going to get on the Mississippi, at least in my mind. I don't know about you.
Oh, absolutely. It runs, I probably should have this memorized. I have another book that's just for the Great River Road, but it's something like 25 or 2,700 miles on each side of the river. So you can drive down one side and turn around and come back up the other side, depending upon how much time you want to kill. I really hope, though, when people do this drive, that my goal is to help people slow down with these trips.
Yeah.
I think the beauty in the river comes from spending time and really watching and observing things and slowing down. I hope more people do that rather than trying to squeeze in 1,000 miles in 4 days or something.
Yeah. There's so many towns, places along, which you recount in your book.
Yeah. There are just all kinds of little beautiful river towns along the way. And there's always, you know, it seems like there's always a bar right next to the river that's got good burgers and fries and good views, so, and good stories. There's like some river rats hanging out in there that'll talk your ears off.
Yeah, the Kenny Solway almost talked my ear off more than one time, who wrote, and I think you mentioned him in the book, in your book, The Last River Rat. This is a great book.
Oh, I love that book. And it really had a big influence on me, too, because he just does such a great job of detailing how the life along the river changes across the seasons. I thought it was a beautiful book.
Yeah. Tim and Madison, your turn. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Larry. Yeah, talking about narratives about the Mississippi River, as a history teacher and history buff, you know, reading some of those early narratives, you know, like from Father Marquette or Zebulon Pike or Henry Schoolcraft, you know, it's just gives a great opportunity to learn more about what the river was like, you know, decades and centuries ago. So I would recommend that to any history buffs that want to learn more about, you know, the history river. The Mississippi River that way.
Yeah, Tim, thank you so much for calling. Dean, you'd agree with that, I bet.
I would. There's a guy named Thomas, I'm going to butcher his name, Thomas Rice Smith, who has a book that he wrote kind of summarizing those early travel narratives along the Mississippi. I think those books are really interesting, and they continue to this day. People are still writing books about their experiences traveling along the Mississippi. So, I think it's a great genre, and every one of those kind of gives you a slightly different perspective on the river and the river at different points in time.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite spot on the river?
Yeah, boy. I'm still partial to La Crosse in a lot of ways. I know I'm not supposed to pick favorites as somebody who writes about the entire river and is trying to talk about the whole river. I lived in La Crosse for 6 years when I was in college, and I stuck around for a year after that, and I'm still so attached to that part of the river. I like the scenic beauty, the bluffs, and the ease of getting on the water there, and the fact that there's still those lush backwaters intact in a lot of places. I think it's just any place in that area, especially in the Driftless area, is high on my list.
Yeah, I would agree. I've been up there in the fall to do a little bird watching on the fall migration up through that area is fantastic.
Absolutely. And I will say too, downplay this, but I really love the lower Mississippi as well. And I think more people should find ways to experience that and see the beauty in that as well. It's just that it's a little harder to access for most of us, because for some of it, you really kind of need a boat, whether it's a canoe or something with a motor. But you really need a boat and a chance to get out on the water and stay there for a little while to fully appreciate that, I think.
Yeah, I think you're probably right about that. We didn't mention much about Missouri, but what's your favorite spot in Missouri?
I love, one of the easiest places for me to get to is up at the confluence of the Missouri and Mississippi. There's a place called Columbia Bottom State Conservation Area, and I love hiking there. I've been up there a lot the last few years. So that's great, because sometimes the river gets low and the back channel dries out, and I can walk to an island, which is a fun experience. But second favorite, I love Trail of Tears State Park, where, for the reminder of the history, but also for the natural beauty in that particular area.
Yeah, that's got to be a really thoughtful place to visit and reflect.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, how's the book doing? Just out.
Well, I hope. It's been out a little over a week or a week. Yeah, I'm losing track of time. It was released on the 21st. So I've been very happy with the feedback I've gotten so far. I'm thrilled to have this book out. Like, I joke with folks, like, anytime a book comes out, I feel this mix of excitement and terror, because I'm never entirely sure what the reception's going to be. And I put a lot into this book. I really wanted this to be something that people would turn to and would help them see the river in a new way. So hopefully it's doing that.
I think it is, Dean. And I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. It's been a real pleasure talking with you and learning more about the Wild Mississippi. That's the title of Dean's book, by the way. The Wild Mississippi, a state-by-state guide to the river's natural wonders. Been a pleasure talking with him. And a whole lot more coming up, so you stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us here on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller, and today we're talking about traveling to lesser-known places to have new and unique experiences. And we're joined by Nithya Chambers, who is Senior Vice President of Content and Executive Editor of Lonely Planet, a publisher of guidebooks for destinations worldwide. Chambers recently or previously served as Vice President of Content Experience at CNN, where she won an Emmy Award in 2018 for her work on Explore Parts Unknown, the digital counterpart to Anthony Bourdain's Parts Unknown. So as we talk with Nithya, I hope you'll join in. Are there interesting places in the Midwest that you have visited or have yet to get to? Are you looking for maybe some recommendations for where to spend your next vacation? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Nithya Chambers, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
So excited to be here, Larry. Thanks for having me.
So I want to talk about Lonely Planet just to start with a little bit. For a long, long time, probably decades, it has been known for really in-depth country and city-specific guidebooks. And the books have been especially valuable, I think, for those world travelers who are looking for immersive experiences, you might say, and on a budget. Are you still doing that?
I think we are. I think we really, like, at the core, Lonely Planet has been around for 50 years. You're right. Decades is right. I think one of our, you know, I think one of the core things about us is that we adapt to travel consumers. And so we've changed even in the books that we make and, you know, certainly digital offerings and social media and newsletters. Like, we've really evolved to meet customer needs. But I think at the core of it, we've always believed in every product that we make that the world is better when more people are traveling and more people are encouraged to travel and more people can find the type of travel experiences, whether it's based on budget, whether it's based on the people you're traveling with, whether it's based on the things you want to do, like an immersive experience, a hidden gem, I want to eat and drink the whole time, that meet travelers where they are and encourage them outside of their comfort zones to try something new, to explore the world, to disconnect. So certainly budget is part of it, but it's really about how can we get more people out there and into the world.
Yeah, yeah. And you became editor, executive editor in 2021, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep.
And the announcement said that you would be leading the reimagining of Lonely Planet's content strategy. So what are you working on and how's it going?
Well, I think what's so fascinating about a brand like Lonely Planet and about travel is that there is something about the act of traveling that is timeless. So our books business is so critical to our identity and still so much a part of our future. But increasingly, as people are traveling and their phones have become not only an appendage of themselves, but how they get all information and make all decisions, we really want to have products that meet them in those moments too. So I think the way we think about our social accounts, the way we think about our website as both inspiration and utility, newsletters and other types of products we can build to meet customer needs and to bring the great content that we've always made to new formats is really part of that challenge, and it is ongoing.
Yeah, I bet it is. I still like a book, though. Of course, I'm an older guy, so I still like to have that book in front of me.
There is definitely like a security to traveling with a book. And I think another really nice thing about just the option of a book is the option to sometimes you don't want to be interrupted by everything on your phone. And there's an opportunity to check out a little bit and be in the place where you are. So I think we're gonna be seeing more of the desire for people to have a little bit of space from how their phone represents a connection to their everyday life in the way that they travel. And so I think that kind of phone-free travel is definitely a trend that we are seeing.
Well, there's not a battery to wear out when you've got a book.
Yeah, that's true. Very, very true.
As my phone often runs out of juice just at the wrong time. Well, here you've got this new book out. I have it in front of me. It is a beautiful book. It's the title, I'll give that again. It's Offbeat North America, and then the subtitle, 100 Amazing Places Away from the Tourist Trail. And you've opened my mind up to quite a few places. And I was kind of concentrating a bit on the Midwest, just thinking, well, where can I drive in a day or so and see some kind of really cool things that are a little off the beaten track?
Absolutely. And that's exactly the idea. I think that's honestly how I plan a lot of my family travel. I have two kids. They're 12 and 9. You know, how do we all get in a car? Think about, for us, I live in New York, where we're flying into, where we're trying to go, and what we can see along the way. And I think I felt that way when I looked at this book, too. Really mind-opening, and the specificity of the recommendations along with the pictures, it really... Like, it's already made me kind of rearrange what I want to do this summer. So
yeah,
it's exciting, and I'm glad to hear you say that.
It's I was really dumbstruck at times with some of the photography. The photography in here is just, you capture a sight. Talk about how it's how the book's organized. I think that'd probably be worth it for people.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, you know, Offbeat North America, as you say, it's an extension of a book we did last year called Offbeat. It's the original Offbeat that's global. And I think it was in response to the notion that people are really increasingly looking for fewer crowds, more affordability, destinations that feel special, that feel less commonplace, and that might not come up in their own searches or are on a list of recommendations. And I think one of the things that I really love about this book, I mentioned the specificity. I think sometimes if you Google search something, you come across a list. You're like, okay, now how do I decide between these 10 things? You know,
yeah.
Like these all sound great. So what I love about this is it's like, this feels very much like highlighting a single thing. And it was really important to us in the North America book. There were 75 main entries and 25 shorter ones, but we really wanted to have a geographic spread, include destinations for every state, having a balance of places to go that featured nature, that featured cities, that featured different kinds of geography and experiences. So the book is really a collection of that diversity in North America, and how I think achievable it is from so many major cities and towns across the country.
Yeah. And, you know, it's you've got first-time tips and in there, in your book, and you have amazing crowd-free experiences for these places as you go along, and a nice little summary about the spot, about each place.
Yeah, and I think that one of the features I really like too is, like, there's a section called Go If You Like. So it's kind of like, if you like the Appalachian Trail, you know, you might like the Ice Age Trail. And I think there's a nice way of connecting readers to maybe more popular attractions or more photographed attractions, and helping them sort of understand what a connection point might be to an experience that is a little bit more removed from what they might have come across.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you do acknowledge in the book, or I should say the book acknowledges, that over-tourism does a lot of harm to the, and sometimes profound harm to the natural environment. Is that a difficult thing for a, here you are, a kind of a tourism-related company to have to admit to? Or
absolutely. I think over-tourism is, you know, I think, you know, it's a balance to me saying, like, the world is better when more people travel. And we believe that because there is a, I think you're changed by travel for the better. You come in contact with people you might have never interacted with before. You try new foods. You see things that you can't even imagine exist on this earth, like the pictures in these books. And then, and that is transformative, and you come back a changed person. I think at the same time, as human beings, we have a responsibility to each other to go places, to go there respectfully, to be conscious of the environments we're in, to leave no trace. And I think that how we travel, and increasingly when we travel, we talk about the shoulder season or slow travel, which is like traveling during the off season, going for longer periods of time, as a way of offsetting kind of that crowd that comes all at once and sometimes feels suffocating to a place and to other travelers.
Yeah, and as you say in the book, and I was where I had that written down, and it's travel is the, you say, is the best education for building a better, more inclusive, more compassionate world. And yeah. I've done a lot of traveling, and I think it certainly helped me in that way, in those ways.
Absolutely. And I also think, like, you know, when you travel so much, when you travel, regardless of how often you travel, you're often just put into situations where you're trying new things. And trying new things, I think, creates a sense of vulnerability. And that vulnerability is really, I think it's an important experience to have. It helps you relate to the people around you that might be navigating the environment that you think is very normal and regular as something new. And so I think there's just a great deal of empathy that comes with that and compassion for each other in the experience of being vulnerable in a new place, trying something new, seeing something new, eating something new.
We are talking today with Nithya Chambers, who is executive editor of Lonely Planet and publisher of guidebooks, of course, and destinations worldwide. And the book we're talking about from Lonely Planet is titled Offbeat North America, 100 Amazing Places Away from the Tourist Trail. Kind of a coffee table-sized book with just absolutely beautiful photography of these. It's hard for me to imagine that these places are offbeat. I mean, is that what you mean when you say offbeat? They're just not visited?
I think one of the things that we really tried to do in this was to, like, you know, and to talk a little bit about the process of it. The destinations in the book are selected through a group brainstorm. We're pitched ideas from a pool of travel writers. We have a network of 750 travel writers. And then we have a solid list of ideas to start with that gets bigger and then smaller and then bigger and smaller as we whittle it down to what we can publish in a book. This is really meant for travelers that are looking to escape swarms of people and to really get off the beaten path. And so a lot of, I think, what we were looking for in this was places that aren't getting the attention they deserve. Sometimes because the popular destinations tend to be, as I said, more crowded, more expensive. But we all love to find something that feels like a special find. And I feel like this book took a lot of places that might have been supporting characters and made them main characters.
There you go. I like that way to look at it. Oh, our guest today, Nithya Chambers, editor of Offbeat North America. You can join in, and I hope you will. What's your favorite offbeat destination? Do you enjoy being a tourist? Or maybe you prefer to go to places where you kind of blend in a little bit? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for listening in today. Larry Mueller here talking with Nithya Chambers, who is executive editor of Lonely Planet. And the book that we're talking about from Lonely Planet is Offbeat North America, 100 Amazing Places Away from the Tourist Trail. And again, you can join in 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. Anne in Neillsville, we'll go to you. Thank you for calling.
Hello, Larry and Nithya.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Well, I wondered if any place in Clark County is mentioned in her book, Offbeat Places.
Well, what did you have in your mind?
Clark County, Wisconsin has Levis Mound. It's an off-road biking and ski trail and hiking that's just wonderful for family outings. And you can camp if you don't need electricity. Then there is Wildcat Mound. Be sure that you enter mound, not mountain, which is near Levis Mound. And I would not recommend it for little kids. It's pretty steep, and the drop-offs are pretty steep in some places, but the vistas and the views are fantastic. And then Bruce Mound has summer hiking, which is wonderful, but its big claim to fame is its winter recreation. It has a three- or four-lane tubing hill and ski lifts to bunny hills and kind of medium experience downhill skiing.
All right. Well, I'm pretty sure that is not included in your book, Nitya, but is that's a kind of an offbeat thing that you might recommend to somebody.
Yeah, I think the greatest thing about these lists and doing shows like yours, Larry, are the recommendations you get. The minute you put something forward, like what you hear from folks about their local favorites, their like off the beaten path finds. Like I just wrote down three notes. Like, you know, the great news is we also have because of our digital platforms, there are tons of opportunities to highlight some of these places. But the thing I love about books like this and lists like this is the minute you put something forward, someone's like, oh, but you forgot my favorite. And that's how those recommendations, those word of mouth recommendations are how you find great places. And honestly, like you build a road trip. So it's a lot of fun to hear. We did feature in Wisconsin, the Ice Age Trail, which I would, if you've been, I'd obviously love to hear from you, but the Ice Age Trail, and I swear I'm not saying this because I'm on this show, but the Ice Age Trail was the one that I was looked at that made me want to rethink what we were doing this summer. just because, you know, I think like the idea of following the edge of a glacier on a hike and a hiking trail that is like still having new segments added, and really being able to be in the presence of so much glacial geology, felt really exciting to me. So I don't know if you have any recommendations on the Ice Trail or anything else in Wisconsin, but it was a standout for me.
Yeah, I haven't hiked the whole trail, but there are people who have, and I've had them on my show, and it's an amazing experience. And I got to tell you, Nitya was. I watched her writing all this down as you were talking about it. So she actually did write down those places in Clark County. And Clark County is a wonderful place to visit anyway. So thank you so much for that call. Sabrina in Kenosha has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Sabrina.
Hi, I'm just wondering when is the best time to travel, especially with like limited funds and a child that you have.
Yeah, so is maybe May a better time to travel or June better, or what do you think?
Yeah, I think, I so much of this is dependent also on the age of the child. I think if you have kids under five, maybe that aren't in formal school yet, you have a little bit more flexibility on when you can go. I have kids in the public school system in fourth grade and seventh grade, and that makes it very rigid for when we go. But when we travel, what we try to do, like I said, one of the things we've started to do is pick crowded destinations in the off season. So maybe not everything is open the way that it would be in peak season. This year we went to Arizona in February, which is not a time a lot of people go to Arizona to go hiking, but it was empty, it was affordable. And there was a lot we could get into, even though there were parts of it that were patches of it that were icy. And so to me, I think opportunities to maximize your money are finding those places to go and those windows to go that aren't in peak season. And obviously what makes sense for you and your family. If driving makes the most sense, like draw a radius around where you're based, an hour, 2 hours drive, and see how to make a weekend of it or make a week of it. I think sometimes house rentals can be more affordable than hotels, and there's a little bit of research that you have to do to kind of follow what's going to make the most sense. But that's the great advantage of having so much information at your fingertips.
Yeah. And I noticed in the book, there were places in the book where you said, well, this is a good time to visit a particular place might be during this time period.
Yeah, and the book definitely has what time periods to go. I still think, like, I always do a little bit of research on just, because there are time periods to go sometimes when the weather is amazing. There are time periods to go where it's less crowded. The weather might be a little bit more unpredictable. And so you have to kind of decide what your family will be able to, or your friend group or your traveling group or you are able to tolerate in that. I can tell you that we walked up to the Grand Canyon and it was filled with fog. that was a really great experience for my family, but that was a risk we took by going in February. But I think that, you know, doing a little bit of research, and I think the other great thing about the book is that it highlights, you know, when there are, like free art shows or community events and music, and really being able to plug into cultural centers of places without having to spend a lot when you're on the ground there, is another great way to stretch out a trip and stretch out your dollars when you're traveling.
Sabrina, thanks a lot for calling. Again, you can join in too. If you got a place that you would like to recommend or a question, please do. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. Let's pick a few places. Minnesota, some of the offbeat locations in the Midwest. The one that caught my eye was the Iron Range of northern Minnesota. Yeah. Which is kind of off the track of you know, how we often travel through that state here in Wisconsin.
Absolutely.
At least. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think that one of the things that was also really kind of what caught my eye in, like, the headline of it was that history meets scuba diving.
Yes.
in this unheralded, like, northeastern corner of Minnesota. And I think, you know, for your listeners, you know, it's about 170-mile stretch through northeast Minnesota. It stretches southwest to northeast. There are 6 active mines. It's a densely forested region. I think a lot of local history, because iron ore was discovered there in the late 1800s. And so you have immigrants from more than 20 European countries sort of all who have like built communities in that area. And it's, I think, a real place for solitude. You know, it's Minnesota, so there's no shortage of lakes. And the towns are few and far between. So I think it's really, like, an amazing place for this, for local history, for natural beauty. But if you really wanted to check out and have some alone time, I think it sounds like a place you can do that.
Yeah, it does indeed. My daughter just got back from, she was on a research project in Grenada where she was doing quite a bit of scuba diving, many hours a day. And so I thought, oh, that's one that she would like. There's even, I think, Lake Orbegon in Gilbert is 400 feet deep, and it has a sunken plane wreck you can go and visit, go down and take a look at. So that to me was pretty cool. But if you kept going, you'd get to Fargo.
Yeah.
I've been to Fargo, and I agree with you. Fargo is a pretty kinky, not kinky, a cool place. Let's put it, a different kind of place than you might expect.
Yeah, and I think the culture and community and sort of this, I think this idea of, like, a strollable city, public art, I think a lot of diversity in dining. I think, you know, I've heard a lot about a lot of indigenous chefs and restaurants that really bring a lot of, and restaurants that bring a lot of the local produce together and when they're serving people, a lot of farm to table. And I think that notion of, like, you know, a city surrounded by farmland and what that brings to kind of the dining experience and the cultural experience is really exciting to kind of, to, like, the idea of, like, landing there and finding that.
Yeah. And there's a, what, Art Alley, I think it is, and you can take your own spray paints, and if you want to, you can paint on the walls of the buildings in that one section of the city, which I, and you had a great photo of some of the art on it, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, and I think the way they captured it in the piece is Fargo having like a scrappy DIY spirit. And I think that really, that I think, you know, when you read about the Art Alley, it certainly feels that way. I know that for me, go ahead.
No, go ahead. That's all right.
I was going to say Fargo is actually, we have plans to do a 2026 Dakotas road trip. So Fargo is my starting place. Teddy Roosevelt National Park. I want to go to the Teddy Roosevelt Library that's opening there in 2026, and then to swing back through the Badlands. So I sort of like, I feel like Fargo feels like a really nice starting and ending point for like what could be an interesting road trip through the Dakotas.
Well, yeah, and South Dakota, which you also have you have a fantastic picture of the Bear Butte Mountains.
Yeah.
And this living cathedral.
Absolutely. I think the exciting thing about the Bear Butte Mountains was, one of the things I really liked about the way it was framed is this, the idea of it being just, it's like such a sacred, special place, which I think when you go to so many of these national parks, state parks, monuments, you really feel that sense of history, of spirituality, and generations in the places that you go. And I think Bear Butte is no exception. Really a dynamic and living cathedral. And this, you know, the granite spires and the domes in Custer State Park. And the idea that it is like a sacred and spiritual place for generations of Native Americans, I think certainly adds to the visual beauty of it as well.
Oh, it's, yeah, a beautiful, beautiful place for sure. Well, I wanted to go back to Minnesota for just a minute because you recommend the Superior National Forest and the Boundary Waters Canoe Area, which a lot of people in Wisconsin are familiar with. These are kind of popular destinations for Midwesterners, but you can still feel secluded there. So is that kind of why these destinations made the cut?
Yeah, I think because there's like space, right? There's that sense of space. There's a sense of it feeling, though they are popular destinations to Midwesterners, they're pristine. I think, you know, certainly a dream for somebody that is a paddler or canoes. And I think there's a vastness to the remoteness of the landscape and the trees and the waterways. And so I think there is that still that ability, even though they're popular and well-known in the Midwest, that you can go there and still have some seclusion. I think is just a really thrilling prospect.
Yeah, yeah. And I wanted to go back to the Ice Age Trail for just a minute too, because there's a few people who have, but not very many, who have thru-hiked that trail, the entire trail. But a lot of volunteers are needed to build the trail. And is the idea to encourage people to experience the trail in unique ways and maybe become to love the trail?
I think so. I think I also have to say, like, you know, and the experience I'm referencing here is my husband and his brother hike a part of the Appalachian Trail every year. So that is something that they've done for like almost the last 10 years. And it's an annual tradition of theirs. And one of the things they talk about a lot, and I was really struck by it in the mention here, is the community around the trail, the volunteers, like the towns that spring up, that have been there, the towns that kind of, that spring up, but are really there, that are really there with a culture and a vibrancy of their own, that know how to welcome hikers of all kinds. You're a first time hiker, you're an experienced hiker. And there's really like just a generosity of spirit in that hiking community. And so I think when I read that when I read about the ice trade shale, that the community that supports it, the volunteer community that supports it, is such a critical part in its, not just its maintenance, but its growth and its future. Like, that made it feel like such a special place to me, because I think people are always the thing that makes something magical.
And excuse me, I also wanted to mention, this kind of going along with what you've been talking about, the Shawnee National Forest in Southern Illinois is included in the book, and it's included in the book for being at a unique ecological crossroads. I think it,
yeah,
the forest includes a 160-mile river-to-river trail. And I think it goes from the Ohio River to the Mississippi River. Do you think Lonely Planet readers are more likely to embark on ambitious hikes like this than the other kinds of travelers, maybe?
I think that there is definitely, for Lonely Planet travelers, a desire to do something that feels different and special and makes a mark, that they're telling a story about the places that they've been, and you're like, oh, where's that? You know, I would have never thought to do that. Oh, it's about 5 hours south of Chicago, right? I think there's a desire to be a person who kind of discovered, like, the unique thing, and to have gone and, like, you know, smelled it and tasted it and touched it with your hands and feet and, like, really, like, been there. I thought the thing about Shawnee that was really exciting to me was that it's the only place in the United States you can hike through 6 ecosystems in one day. So
yeah.
Forest, wetlands, prairie, bluffs, and canyons. And like, I think speaking to what you said about the unique ecological crossroads, like, to me, you're like, if you just describe that, I don't know that I would have thought that was in Illinois. but it feels worth the adventure to go get there.
Jim in Wasaki has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Jim.
Hello. I just wanted to comment about your earlier program, biking along the Mississippi River.
Yeah.
But also another place in northern Minnesota that a lot of people don't get to is Voyageur National Park.
Yeah.
It's out of International Falls, and it's right on the border between U.S. and Canada.
Yeah, I've been there. It's a it is a beautiful place. Anyway, comment on that, Nithya?
No, I think, again, I love getting the recommendations. I wrote this one down too, because I think there is always more to see.
Thanks, Jim. Appreciate that very much. Because it is a beautiful, beautiful area. You can join in too. Number to call 800-642-1234, or you can email us to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mailer, talking today with Nithya Chambers about the Lonely Planet book, Offbeat North America. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, have you figured out where you're going this summer for a vacation? Do you want some offbeat, maybe off-the-beaten-track places to visit? You might want to pick up a copy of Offbeat North America from Lonely Planet. Has a lot of really cool photos and a lot of great information about places that are a little off-the-beaten-track and maybe not cost you as much money as maybe some of the other places, but will provide you with a really wonderful experience. Join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, and email to talk@wpr.org. I wanted to mention Michigan once because most of the guidebooks that mention Isle Royale National Park mention it as that it's one of the least visited national parks in the U.S., and your book says that as well. And I've had a chance to, I haven't visited it myself, but talked to the authors of some research done there. I think it draws about 25,000 people a year, so that's probably the least number of people to visit a national park. but it's pretty cool.
Extremely cool. I one of the other ones that kind of hit my radar, I think, you know, for the listeners, like a 45-mile island floating between Michigan and Minnesota and Lake Superior. No roads, just hiking and campgrounds and kayaking and canoeing. I thought the, you know, the write-up talked about like the relationship between the moose and the wolves there. Just the really unique ecosystem for those two animals. And there's a very long running study on predator prey based on those two animals there. And I think like, you know, I think with something that's that remote, it's also a serious effort to get there. I think it's only ferry or seaplane. Once you're there, there's no cell service. But to me, I feel like the beauty of it and the experience, you know, we talked at the very beginning, Larry, about the experience and the immersion of being somewhere that where you've made that much effort, you're that disconnected, and then you can just be present in something that is so unique, can feel very thrilling.
Yeah, there's always this little tension. You wonder, or maybe you've thought of this too, do you ever worry about drawing attention to a largely unspoiled place could result in too many people going and spoiling it?
I think that that is certainly part of the challenge of making the hidden gems unhidden. But I think that's also why it's very important to talk about the responsibility we have as travelers, to go to places, to respect the space that you're in, to operate as a guest in someone else's house and really leave no trace while you're there. And so I think for to us, like the again, very important to us to create lots of pathways to the experience of travel for all kinds of budgets and all kinds of interests, but at the same time, really make sure we're talking and grounding ourselves in that responsibility we have to the places that we go and maintaining them, making them better.
And making them better. Karen in Fox Crossing will give you a chance. Hi, Karen.
Hello there. We had three boys, all 4 years apart. And for years, because it was affordable, we went camping all different places. Camping for the first half of the vacation and then in a motel, which the kids thought was very cool. For the second half, and while we were at the second half, we visited historical sites or like up, well, I don't remember if it's actually in Canada or if it's in northern Minnesota, but they got to do amethyst hunting. We did historical programs at state parks. There are dozens of state and county parks in Wisconsin that are wonderful places to take your family.
Yeah. Thanks, Karen, for calling in. It's true. I mean, if you're on a budget, it sounds like she had that nailed.
Yeah, and I'm so glad she said that because I've been thinking about Sabrina's question since she asked it. And I think that, you know, camping and car camping are great ways to stretch a budget when you are traveling. I also think that, state and national parks also have all kinds of like free days, free weeks, opportunities during the week to go where you can save on when you go and who you're going with and how big your group size is. So I think there are a lot of options built into that to make it affordable, but still get that opportunity and that option to check out of your day-to-day life and see something new.
It's a Christmas gift that I usually give every year to more than a few people is a state park sticker.
Yep.
And you think about it, well, I don't know, what is it, 30 or 40 bucks or whatever it is. I can't remember off the top of my head, but it allows you to go to any state park in Wisconsin for free. You can go on in and look around and hike and see a lot of wonderful, wonderful places and the wildlife as well.
Similarly, the national parks have for fourth graders if you have a fourth grader in your family, a free parks pass that they can apply for. You print out a form, you take it to the park you're going to, and your family gets a free annual pass for the year. I think another really great program for some of the national parks, and super fun for the fourth grader who gets to be that ambassador for the family.
Barbara in Cross Plains called to suggest the Keweenaw Peninsula in the UP of Michigan. It's right on Lake Superior, great for kayaking and mountain biking. And Joel Patnaud, our producer, is going on vacation next week. And I think he likes what Barbara had to say from Cross Plains about the Keweenaw Peninsula, because that's where he's going. Oh, man. I wanted to point out there are some places just that struck me like not a thunderbolt, but I was thinking about Columbus, Indiana. Now, I've been to Indianapolis many times, and I never drove the extra 40. Well, I didn't know to drive the another 40 minutes or so to Columbus, Indiana, with this living museum of mid-century modern architecture.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, like, that was really, like, a surprise to me, too, right, hearing that J. Irwin Miller commissioned in the late 40s, I think, commissioned some of the world's most revered architecture, designing, like, I think something like 70 of the city's, like, public private buildings and a bunch of public art installations. That felt like that thing, imagining driving into that, surrounded by coming out of cornfields and red barns and basketball hoops and driveways, just really felt, you know, again, it's like something you have to see.
I mean, suddenly it's there and you've got photos of the, and I like mid-century modern architecture anyway, but some of the photos you have in the book are absolutely fantastic. And I mean, there's, you can hardly spend any money at all and be exposed to some really great art. And it was, yeah, Irwin Miller, was it? That the, they had a Fortune 500 engineering firm.
Yeah.
So he had a lot of money. And he said, I'm just going to get all these architects in here and we're going to build these buildings.
Yeah, and I think, like, it, you know, he had clearly had a vision for what Columbus, Indiana was going to be. I think what's exciting about it to me is, like, I, you know, the way you even just said, you've been to Indianapolis a bunch of times, but never thought to make that drive. Like, I think we, a lot of times, you know, you can certainly make any of these places a destination. Sometimes you're also going to a city and you're looking for a day trip out of the destination. And I feel like that's a perfect thing to do for a day. Not a long drive, something that is unexpected and revealing about the history of the United States, as well as just like in your personal week or weekend. And I feel like that's just also such a great way to punch up a trip, kind of take a little detour inside of a trip and see something you didn't expect.
And as long as we're talking about cities named Columbus, we first we've got Columbus, Ohio, too, which you I was absolutely amazed to learn that Columbus, Ohio has the third highest concentration of fashion designers in the country.
Yeah, I was. There's always like trivia like that that you come across. I think, you know, it, like to me, it felt really like a city of surprises. And here again, you hear about like walkable neighborhoods and really just a strong cultural core with an international feel alongside, I think, all this art and fashion and design. And I feel like that felt really, again, exciting and unexpected in Columbus.
Well, yeah, and the and you've got the, what is it, the Wettner Center for the Arts, the Columbus Museum of Arts. It's sounds like a fantastic place, an interesting place to visit. But Columbus, Indiana was one that caught my mind. And I'm and it's, I mean, this is why this is a great book, because... You can find, you know, I want to go and see that place. I've never been there before. I've never done that thing. And I'm just learning the book is, actually, the book is sold out. Could be purchased on Amazon, though.
Yeah, and it's in bookstores. So I
oh,
think
it's in book. Okay,
it's in bookstores. So you can get it in bookstores. You can certainly get it online. And we encourage you to do you and your listeners to do so.
Yeah, absolutely. Somebody else. There actually is several emails here that I should probably mention a few of them. Leslie in Cottage Grove, Wisconsin, emailed to recommend the Kovac Planetarium in Monaco, which is near Rhinelander, Wisconsin. It was built by Frank Kovac in honor of his father. It's awesome, off the beaten track, affordable, unique, and great for all ages, and kind of a must-see. And if I'm not mistaken, it's probably a really good site for a planetarium because the light, light pollution is less there. I'm glad Leslie sent that in. And Pete emailed to say that Rib Mountain State Park in Wisconsin, premier day use property for picnicking, hiking. Park has reservable facilities. There's a big scenic amphitheater, indoor gathering space, and picnic shelters. And the top of the park offers absolutely spectacular views of the Wausau area and the Wisconsin River. And I have been up there, and Pete's exactly right for some wonderful views. It is a great, great place to visit. And let's see, there was one more. Oh, well, I've got so many here. I can't find the other ones. But back to your book, we Dubuque, somebody had called about Dubuque, and we did discuss it in the earlier segment of the show, the Millworks District of Dubuque.
And the frame, I think, of like Iowa's oldest city is like having a moment again. And I think like a lot of the themes around like an art scene, independent boutiques and stores, microbreweries, I think the, you know, murals that are part of like the Voices production in the city, like that art that becomes part of the city, it creates so much character for a place to go, for a traveler to go and visit a place.
And I'm going to mention maybe one or two more. Kansas, the Flint Hills of West Kansas. Boy, you've got the Theodore Roosevelt National Park. Of course, Badlands National Park. And folk art. You mentioned folk art in Kansas and the Flint Hills area as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's the Kansas, and I think like the tall grass and the prairie and the wildflowers, and just that kind of change in landscape and what you might be seeing and used to seeing in a city or in a more mountainous area. But I think that like Lucas, a tiny town to the west, the grassroots like art, music, folk art scene, I think is really part of the community there, and that those. The performances and like the art shows by local poets and storytellers, especially in the summertime, is really part of the allure of the place.
Nithya, we have just scratched the surface of the book here. I want to thank you for taking time to be with us today. It was a lot of fun. I'm sorry we didn't get to everybody on the phone, but that's the way it works sometimes. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me, Larry. I'm glad that you like the book so much.
Our guest today, Nithya Chambers, Senior Vice President of Content and Executive Editor of Lonely Planet, and the book title, Offbeat North America, 100 Amazing Places Away from the Tourist Trail. Thank you so much for listening. Appreciate it very much. Lots more in store here on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller.